Good evening. I'm delighted so many of you are here. I think a lot of you have read every single book. If you've read every book, raise your hand. Oh, that's pretty amazing. I think you probably know that Nevada Barr is the author of 18 Anna Pigeon novels, and she's been nominated for just about every award in the Mystery Universe. She's a New York Times bestselling author. But what I really wanted to talk about was Anna, just really quickly. I think for many mystery readers, mystery fiction has an element of fantasy. You know, when you read about Kinsey Millhone frying up a bologna sandwich and not gaining weight, that's, you know, pretty cool. But I think some series characters, the fantasy is, they are a fantasy of our better selves. And I think that's what Anna is. For me, she is. She's like, that's what I want to aspire. I want to aspire to be like Anna. She's real, but she's also, you know, brave and strong and smart, and boy, does she have great problem-solving skills in this new book. It's very hard to put down. So thank you for Anna, and thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thank you, Rob.
Oh, what a treat. I love libraries. It's the only place I'll speak for free, you know, is libraries, because I got my library card, my first one, I still have it. I was 6 years old, and it was co-signed by my first-grade teacher. And I wrote it out longhand, not printed. And, I mean, where else can anybody, I mean, a politician, a social worker, a known felon, go and take out books because they say they'll bring them back? And I love late fees. I go in, and the book's late, and they say, yeah, this book's really overdue. It's going to be $1.25. God, I can't get anything for $1.25. So I'm so happy to be here tonight. I thought what I'd do is I'd talk a little bit about how I came to be a writer, and then a little bit about the book that brings me here tonight, and then take some questions. Does anybody have a watch so I don't go on forever and ever and ever? Oh, can I borrow that?
I have such a collection.
Okay, this one's good to go. Thank you very much. Well, how many of you guys here are writers? A bunch. So we got a bunch of writers. I'm going to have to lay this down because I haven't worn one in so long I don't know how to fasten it. Okay, please. We're going to have this buckled on. So we got a bunch of writers. I want the writers in the crowd.
I'm going to ask you just to go with it.
Oh, I have to go back. Okay. Back on film. Thank you very much. I wanted to say to the writers in the group that I got, for the Anna Pigeon book, the first one, Track of the Cat, I got an Anthony, and I got an Agatha, and I got nominated for the Edgar and the McCafferty, and I got all these Best First Novel Awards, my fifth book. My first book that was ever published was, I was working in New York City at the time that it was published, before it was published, and the first person who ever read it was my boss at Morgan Stanley on 6th Avenue, you know, the company, and he dubbed it a neo-Gothic lesbian Western. This was a very narrow genre. I was the queen of that genre. And it sold 1,200 copies, most of which Mama bought. But I thought, now, you know, this is it. I'm a writer. I'm off and going. And I didn't sell another book for 10 years. I wrote them. But I didn't sell them. And I live in New Orleans. Did you guys know that? I now live in New Orleans. And I moved there with my unbelievable investment timing. 9 months before Katrina, I bought a double condo, moved to New Orleans. And I had these books that I had written that had never sold. And they were in the basement. And the basement flooded. So now I can say, without anybody being able to prove differently, they were fine literature. The world lost such fabulous books in Katrina. But the truth was, I went to California Polytechnic State University, and the motto of that is learn by doing. and I learned to write by doing it. So the Best First Novel Award was for my fifth book, and it was Winston Churchill who said, never, never, never quit. And my father's advice was a little bit earthier, but it's the same to those of you who are writing. I finally got my first book published before Dad died, and he said, you know, honey, sometimes you just got to wear the bastards down. So that's how I got my first book published. And then I thought, well, here we go. Nothing, 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 nothing. So I decided, I was an actor in Minneapolis, St. Paul by this time. And I'm trying to write, and I'm trying to do this, and nothing. And I fell in love with the Park Service. And I became, I was 37 years old when I became a law enforcement park ranger, because it was the 80s. You know, there was a whole environmental movement and all this sort of stuff. And I was making a living as an actor during the winter, so I could do. In fact, you guys are from here. I bet you've heard my most famous piece. I am a nationally famous actor. I did a lot of voiceovers. Okay, I'm gonna do my most famous piece for you. Close your eyes. You'll know this. I'm sorry. The number you have dialed is no longer in service. Little voiceovers for AT&T there. So I went to work for the Park Service, and I worked for my first season was at Isle Royale after I'd gone to law enforcement school. And isn't that a great place? Oh, God. And, you know, of course, then I did another one there, which was a whole different story. But then I went down to work there, and then I went down for my second summer to Guadalupe Mountains, Texas. All this time I'm writing, I'm being rejected. And I was down there, and I was a backcountry ranger. And have you guys been to Guadalupe Mountains, Texas? A lot of people have. It's what we, you know, call a Texas exclosure. Texas. And then Guadalupe Mountains is this, like, butte that rises 2,500 feet up, and there's no water up there, and there's, you know, if you have to pack in all your water, and it's 4 miles, and, you know, in the desert heat. So I was up there, and it's pretty solitary. In fact, people would come, you know, and they'd want to get away from things and commune with nature. And so they'd load the water on their back, and they'd climb up this 4.5 miles, 2,500 feet, and, you know, in the sweating heat. And here's the range saying, hi, who's president? You want to play cards? Is anything happening? I haven't seen anybody in days. You know? So I was up there, and that was when I started the first Anna Pigeon novel. And it was... How many of you guys are teachers? This is Ann Arbor, probably 50. Tons and tons of teachers. I had a writing class in college taught by Richard Davidson or David Richardson. Nasty little man. And he gave me straight C's because I would sign my work, and he said, how dare you sign your work? If you sign it again, you're not anybody. I'll give you a C. So, of course, I signed my work. He gave me C's. And I have the fantasy, you know, that Richard Davidson or David Richardson's like, you know, like he's in a gutter in New York. And you know, he's got the wine bottle and the paper sack. And he goes by the Barnes & Noble, you know. But I did finally, you know, and people would say, your voice. You find your voice. What's your voice? And my voice was in the first books I wrote, I love old dead English people. Austen, Trollope, Dickens, Shakespeare, Johnson, you know, and so I was trying to write like them, like real writers write, you know. And then when I was in the backcountry in Texas, I came up with the idea of Anna Pigeon. And I started writing very much based on me, but taller, stronger, smarter, better looking, you know, because my book, why wouldn't I do that, you know? And I wrote it the way I would write letters to my sister or talk to somebody in my actual real voice. And it took me, I mean, you cannot imagine the number of years it took me to discover that just that my voice was actually, hello, my voice. And so I started writing them there. And I finished the first one, and Putnam bought it. $7,500 was the 13th submission. And they bought it for $7,500, less my agent's commission, and you know, I was just ecstatic. And then, you don't want to know this, but it's my show, so you got to know it. I was 40 years old. I was going through a horrible divorce. In fact, I came to the conclusion anybody who said they had an amicable divorce wasn't really married. So I had run home to Mama, who lives on the western slope, or did, lived on the western slope of the Sierra, north of Reno, Nevada. And because it was in September that I ran home to Mama, and I was 40 years old. And when my grandmother died, she had on Mama's property an A-frame, you know, those like ski chalet A-frames. Yeah, like a culvert, a pointy culvert. Yeah, exactly. And Mama knew how terribly depressed I was, so she hired the Jones boys, who were local carpenters, to come and knock. It was two stories, you know, just this little pointy attic and then this little nasty downstairs. And so they cut the attic in half to make it a balcony and knock the end out to give a view of Thompson Peak and put a fireplace in. But I learned at 40 that when construction guys say it will be done in 6 weeks, they don't mean in a row. So I was in this A-frame, and Johnny and Jack Joynes had knocked holes for skylights. They'd knocked the end out. They'd covered everything with plastic, and then they had vanished into constructor guy, you know, mist. And it was the worst winter since the winter I was born. There was 8 or 9 feet of snow, and the coyotes would howl out on the meadow in the moonlight in this 9 feet of snow. And Mom and I carved a path between my house, which had plastic holes all over it, and her house, and we were feeding the deer, even though the BLM said don't feed the deer. So you'd be going down this cavern, and the deer would come, and one of you would have to jump into the bank, you know, to get to Mom's house. And Putnam asked me for a second book. They asked me for a book. And, you know, I was thrilled, but all of a sudden you think, I didn't know this was going to be a series. What do you mean a second book? What am I going to do now? So I was sitting there trying to write a second book, and I felt like, what's his name? Jack Nicholson in The Shining. All work and no play, you know. And so I was there trying to write this second book for Putnam, and I got a call from Mississippi offering me a full-time job with medical, dental, and housing. And it was just amazing. I'd never been to Mississippi. Nobody I knew had ever been to Mississippi. My sister, who was a pilot for U.S. Air, said, "We don't even land in Mississippi." So I got in my little Ford hatchback, and we loaded everything I had into the car, and I drove like 36 hours. I mean, I just drove crazy time. And I got there at like, hit Shreveport at about 3 in the morning, stopped for gas, Shreveport, Louisiana. And this young man comes out, and of course I had snow tires. And he comes out, and I'm paying him for the gas, you know, because it's 3 in the morning, so he's doing the service thing. And he said, "Did you know you got nails in your tires?" And I got to the Trace in Mississippi at dawn, about this time of year, about April 6th. And I had pictured sorry, Al, that was a popped pee. Al's my cinematographer guy. So I got to Mississippi, and I had pictured it. I'm 62, just turned 62. So all I knew of Mississippi was from the civil rights stuff on black and white TV. So I was amazed. It was in color. You know, who knew? Who knew? So I'm driving up to the Trace. I'm about 10 miles from the Trace, and the first thing I see as the sun comes up is this big white sign with black lettering that says, "Repent." I drive on about 5 more miles, and there's another big white sign with black lettering that says, "Turn back." And the Trace was the most beautiful place I had seen in ages. It was in the spring, Mississippi. It looked like it had been decorated for a wedding. I mean, the redbud was out, the dogwood was out, and all of the old homesteads that are no longer there, the women planted daffodils and tulips, and they come up every year, even though everything else is gone. So I immediately fell in love with the landscape of Mississippi. And then I fell in love with the wildlife. I mean, it's just, you can just see it. In fact, I was the first woman they ever hired to work on the southern end of the trace, because they thought these good old boys wouldn't like a woman ranger. What they didn't know is they might not like a woman ranger, but I was the age of their mama. And they snapped too. So one of my first stops is big green trucks going about 60 in a 50-mile-an-hour zone on the parkway. So I pull him over, middle of the day, and it's a BLM guy, George, great big black guy. And he had in the back of his truck an alligator that he had taken out of the bathroom of the women's dorm at Mississippi College. Because some boys had thought it would be funny to put this alligator in their shower. So I go around to the back, and in the bed of his truck is about 6'5" to 7-foot alligator. And you know, when they're big, they just look like kind of mud logs. You know, they're kind of ugly. But the little ones, the younger ones, are beautiful. Olive green with gold, and they're really clear, those little pointy things, the dinosaur pointy things they have down their backs. And he had George had one of those big silver tool things, you know, that's behind the cab at the end of it. And the alligator had his head under the tool thing, and his tail was curled around the tailgate of the pickup truck. And I had never seen an alligator except, you know, like on PBS or that kind of thing. And I knew about alligator purses and alligator shoes and stuff, so I wanted to see what he felt like. So I reached down and I grabbed his tail. God, are they fast. Fast. I mean, this alligator whipped around. His head whipped around. But he wasn't as fast as the black guy who didn't want to be known as the guy who fed the first white lady ranger to an alligator. So George grabs me and he just sets me down, you know, about 6 feet away. And my first Christmas card from Mississippi, George took it, and I was in my little ranger costume and everything, and I had the alligator on it was clothesline leash that the boys had left it on. And so I had my alligator on the leash when George took my Christmas card picture that I sent home. I just absolutely loved Mississippi. I was there for 10 years. The people there, I mean, Southern hospitality is so not, you know, a myth. It was just wonderful. I noticed when I was pulling people over, these old beat-up trucks would pull over, you know, with kind of creepy-looking dudes in it. You know, and they'd kind of hang back about 100 yards. And I thought I was being stalked or something. And finally, I went back and confronted one of them. They just wanted to make sure everything went okay. And it was just wonderful. In fact, since I was the new kid, I worked the bad shift. You know, I worked midnight to 8 a.m. or, you know, 4 p.m. to midnight, that kind of thing. And we don't, as rangers don't work two and two. You work by yourself. And in Mississippi, everybody I stopped after dark would say, "Aren't you afraid to be out here by yourself? Aren't you scared of the dark out here all alone? Does your boss know you're out here by yourself?" I'd been there about 6 weeks, and it was 1 a.m. I was kind of sick of this. And I pulled over this powder blue Cadillac going 77 and a 50, 1 a.m. in the morning. I'm exhausted. I pull it over, and driving it is this gorgeous woman, somewhere between 60 and 80. You know, the perfect silver hair, the gigantic diamond ring, and she's sitting there in her powder blue Cadillac, and I'm writing her a ticket, and she says, "Aren't you scared out here all by yourself?" And I'd had it, and I said, "Nope, I've got a great big gun." And she said, "Honey, we all do." And it was true. We ran a roadblock because it was federal instead of state, and we stopped taking guns off people because my trunk got full. You know, it just wasn't worth it. So I had a marvelous time working on the trace in Mississippi. I just loved the people. And I knew that I was writing all this time, writing books, and I realized that it was getting to be a conflict of interests when it's about 96, I guess, and I got my first bestseller. And one of the reasons is because, you know, New York thinks, this is New York, and this is America. And so, and of America, this is Mississippi. And so I wrote Deep South, which was set in Mississippi. And, of course, they believe anything can happen. Do you remember, what was that show, ER, had the black doctor, and he goes to Mississippi for some reason on one of the series things, and he's you know, he's got his suit on, handsome dude, and he's got his jacket over his arm, and he's walking by what looks like, you know, Sudanese refugee camps, and he's trying to find, you know, a doctor, and you're thinking, why don't you take a cab to Methodist and get a heart transplant, dude? You know, totally no idea of what Mississippi was like. So when I wrote Deep South, I mean, I could have put in anything. Fairies, pirates, they would have believed it could happen in Mississippi. So when I pulled a guy over on the trace, and I wrote his ticket, and I signed it, I handed it to him, and he said, ooh, do I have to send this in? You signed it. And I thought, okay, I've got to quit doing this. So I started writing full-time, and I fell in love with a girlfriend of mine. I had a daughter, and in Mississippi, mothers and daughters never, I mean, they're just very close. It's wonderful. And her daughter went to New Orleans. And so my girlfriend got a pied de terre there, you know, an apartment she rented. And I would go there with her, you know, several times a month. And I fell in love with New Orleans. And one of the reasons was in New Orleans, I don't care how weird you are or what you're wearing, you are not the strangest person on the block. Nobody ever asks you, what are you supposed to be? I mean, you know, you can wear a tutu to your job at the steel plant, and nobody will care one way or the other. So I decided to buy a condo there, and with, you know, my incredible investment skills, 9 months before Katrina, I bought two condos. And it turned out to be a good thing, oddly enough, because like any strange society, New Orleans is a real idiosyncratic, wonderful, but, you know, kind of closed in a way society. There's tourists and stuff, but there's New Orleans. And I was like a water bug, you know, the kind of, they skitter along and you see they make footprints, but they don't ever break the water. That was me in New Orleans. And then Katrina hit, and I was back within 3 weeks, and there was nobody in my neighborhood but me. And my whole garden looked like it had been sautéed in rancid pork fat. It was just nasty. And I started replanting the garden, first thing, to get some color. Didn't have power, didn't have anything. And the Army Reserve guys would go by in their Humvees and yell, you go, Mrs. You know, I'm out there with my petunias. And that allowed me, the rebuilding allowed me to actually become a New Orleanian, which I don't think ever would have happened. It had been like where I grew up. My mother owned the ranch where her daddy and her ashes are sprinkled for 40 years. Mother's name was Mary Barr. Dad's name was Dave Barr. And it's still known as the Old Shoe Grew Place. You know, same with New Orleans. So that's what allowed me to get in there. And this book that I'm here tonight for wasn't going to happen. I was going to have The Rope be my last book. You know, perfect full, because, you know, I was getting tired, and I thought that, you know, I'd write, I had all these wonderful ideas, and I'd write all these wonderful, fresh, new things if I wasn't just under this killing contract, you know. And it turns out, no, I won't. It's too hard. I got to have the carrot and the stick, or I won't write. So I finished The Rope, and I started this one. And I was having real, real trouble with it. And so I thought, well, I'm going to think of the straightest forward plot I can think of. And so I thought, okay, if you kill everybody, you get to go home. And it turned out this is the second book that my sister, who is my web maven and does most of my promotion, has liked. She liked 13 and a half, and she liked this book because she likes thrillers. She doesn't like murder mysteries. So this is the 18th one, and been having fun promoting it, and I didn't have fun exactly writing it, but after I got it the way I wanted, I had a wonderful time rereading it, which is a tricky bit. You go back to reread it for typos, and you think, oh God, how many more times can you fool them, you know? But this one was fun to reread. So it is 7:33. I've been babbling on and can do so for hours, unfortunately. But I'm going to stop and take questions. And you can either go to the mic in the back where Tim's got a mic, or you can ask me the question and I will repeat it in this mic if you are in the middle and don't want to get up. Do I ever conduct workshops for writers? I don't. If you gave me a huge sum of money, I would do so. But yeah, I went to Cal Poly, learned by doing, and I did teach. I taught creative writing in graduate school at Mississippi College for the summer semester. I frankly don't know how it's done. I don't know if you guys know Bob Crumley. He was a series writer and a hardcore old, you know, noir kind of guy. And he and Evan Hunter and Harlan Coben and myself and some other people were doing this writer's thing in the Bahamas, and we had a panel, and they were asking, what's the most important thing when you're starting a novel? And Evan, who is very educated, talking about the arc, you know, and I'm talking about the importance of place, and Harlan Coben's talking about the linear importance of a driving plot, and they get to Bob Crumley, sitting there, big Montana guy, you know, all squashed like a big old toad at the end, and they said, what do you think, Bob? And he said, most important thing is putting your butt in the seat. You know, just doing it. So it would be, if I taught a workshop, I wouldn't know what to do other than tell you, okay, write 5 or 6 novels and then see if you're any good. I mean, John Wayne was great after his 30th movie. He was a good actor, you know. So I don't, but thank you for the question. I've done books in cities, as you mentioned, New York and New Orleans, and have I ever thought about Philadelphia? And I haven't. Because in a city, you have to have a serious connection with that city. And I'd lived in New York. And even then, I wouldn't have done a book in New York if I hadn't found Ellis Island, which was in New York but not of New York. It was like it was really a haunted house story with this incredible place that I had found. You know, like I discovered it, Ellis Island. You know, probably my great-grandfather came through there. And in New Orleans, I'd lived there. And I had done a lot of research, which was rather entertaining because I was researching the sex industry. And, you know, Al, you know, you can just cut this out if this is for children, but I decided I'd research the sex industry. And it turned out anything I made up was nothing compared to reality. But I went to a sex club. It was called Coquettes. And it opened at 10 o'clock. And it was a real sex club, you know. So I go down there, and I'm dressed totally Victorian. I don't have a full-length skirt. I don't have my little Victorian shirt. And I went in, and I paid my $80 to be a member. And the downstairs was just a bar disco, you know, people doing bar disco things. And then you get in the elevator, and there was this marvelous young man that greeted you, who flirted with you and made you feel not a day over 50. He was just fabulous. And then we went up the elevator, and the elevator doors opened, and this is, you know, way past my bedtime. And there was like a Sherlock Holmes library, you know, no windows, of course, but, you know, leather furniture and dark books and false plants and stuff, and these big leather couches. And on these leather couches, on one end, there's people doing what one would expect for people to do in a sex club. And I'm standing there, you know, kind of just outside the elevator watching, and on my end there was a woman maybe 35 in full dominatrix stuff, the leather bustier, that, you know, all this stuff. And on the couch, next couch, so they're sitting corner to corner, was a woman in like frothy white baby doll pajamas, you know, and the little high heels and stuff. And so I sidle up to see what they're going to be talking about. And so the dominatrix is saying, so I dropped Pammy off at soccer. Yeah, and it was like, wherever you go, there you are. You know, so that was fun to research. But Philadelphia, I don't have any connection with that I could tie into that would generate a story. So if I found one, I do love Philadelphia, you know, but there's nothing in my mind at the moment. Did I go to Minnesota for the research of this book, Destroyer Angel? I did. In fact, I got the idea because I wanted to bring Heath back from Hard Truth because I love the character. She was in Hard Truth. She had just become a paraplegic from a bad fall while ice climbing. And bitter, bitter woman. And so 5 years later, she comes back, and she is going on this canoe trip with a designer, you know, who designs equipment to help people work, disabled people work better in the wilderness. And so I started, going on the internet, and I found this company in Minneapolis, Blue Sky Designs. And so I email the designer, Sherry, and the owner of the company, Diane, and ask them if they'll help me. Well, I don't know if Diane ever heard of me, but Sherry was a big fan of mine. She thought it was a joke, so she didn't answer. Thought one of her friends was messing with her. So finally she answers, and I went up there, and they showed me, all of the stuff they were designing, that you could hold stuff in your wheelchair, you could do all these different things. And then I met with a friend of theirs. He's an athlete. His name is Steven Saylor, and he teaches sailing on Lake Michigan. And when he was 15, there was a bad accident, and he became a paraplegic. And so he has all these things he does. He gets in and out of his boats. He does these different things. So I talked with Steven for a long time. He gave me my favorite line in the book. They don't teach this shit in therapy. But then I went up to the North Country where I saw in its natural habitat a wolf. All this time on Isle Royale, even with the wolf study group, Never saw a wolf. I saw them where you see all wildlife. He was running across the road in front of our car. Yeah, big black wolf. So we went up there, and I was trying to move. Like, I tried to drag my husband. My husband tried to drag me. I tried to crawl on my belly like a reptile. And I ended up, finally, Stephen told me the way you could move best was you just back, inch by inch. 50 feet was an impossibility, drenched in sweat. So, and as I was doing this stuff, because I'd always thought being strong and not suffering illnesses except, clinical depression, so what. But, other than that, there was us, the abled, and there was them, the disabled, poor things. And I realized when I was writing this book, we're all disabled. Some of it's obvious. You see somebody in a wheelchair, they're not going to be sprinting around the room anytime soon. But the rest of us, there's, anything from a bad knee to chronic migraines, So I guess I changed it from us and the disabled to us the disabled and then to us the differently abled. And the whole concept of us and them vanished because, it is just this sliding scale. So I did go up there and crawled around and did that. And I went to, in fact, I put Sherry and her wife, Barb, they're now married, in the book because they're the ones taught me all about mushrooms. And we stayed at their place north of Duluth. Beautiful. And Barb is a nurse anesthetist, and Sherry is a homemaker. She made the home. She made the fireplace. She made the barn. She built all this stuff. And so we stayed at their house and then went up northwest into the Iron Country and experienced these different things. And the second one, if I ever thought of doing a one-woman show, I think the two most terrifying professions in the world would be stand-up comic and poet. So my poetry is going to be buried with me when I die and not going to do any one-woman shows.
Hi, thanks. This will be a little different take. I am big fan, but I've never read any of your books.
The best kind. Disappointments.
No, but I've listened to them all because I do so much driving, and I love Barbara Rosenblatt. And I don't know if you know her, if you have any input to it. And I've recently read or listened to a more recent novel, and the author read it, and she said, those of you who have listened have understood it differently than those of you who have read it. And so it suddenly gave real, credence to those of us who listen to the books. And I love them. And I don't know, especially after you said you've done voiceovers, what input you might have had to some of her performances.
Well, I offered to do my own books, and they said, you can come audition. But it is a unique talent, and Barbara did the first one, and she did a bunch, and then I wasn't paying attention, and they hired somebody else. And everywhere I'd go on tour, they'd say, wrong. And so last year I called, I said, we have to have Barbara back. She is the voice of Anna Pigeon. And the reason I really totally realized is I listen to books all the time on tape. And you do hear them differently, much more critically, because most of us here can read like the wind. I mean, we read fast. A few little Gerbers, we slide right through there. So the person calls everything a huge affair. You don't even notice. You read so fast. When you're listening to it, you hear every wrong note. And I was listening to the Amelia Peabody series by Barbara Peters, which I just love. And Barbara Rosenblatt read some of them, and they cost $30. And then somebody else read some, and they cost $20. And I paid the extra $10 for Barbara, and I thought, okay, I got to call up audio and tell them this has to be done. So, yeah, I'm a big audiobook fan. After I quit doing my research on your tax dollar as a national park ranger, which was sublime, the question was, did I research the places? And I did. Not only is it one of my great joys, but it's absolutely necessary for me because the information you can get from pamphlets. You can get it from Wikipedia. You can download it from the park's website. But I have to go there for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, and roll around and smell stuff and taste stuff and feel stuff. And you got to hang out with the rangers because the first 2 days, everything's perfect. Thank you. And then after a few glasses of wine, you're sleeping on their sofa. You know, you hear what's happening and you get some good stories. So, yes, I do go there both for pleasure and because for me it is necessary to... The park is a character in the Anna Pigeon books. It's not a place, it's a character. It is an antagonist or a protagonist or a support. And you can't do that without having rolled around in it. When I was doing Carlsbad Caverns, and there was this guy, he's going down, we went down, there was this huge guano mine. It wasn't in the caverns, and it was like huge, huge, huge piles of bat shit everywhere. They carved through, you know. And we get down there walking through it, and this guy's so laid back, and he said, yeah, he said, these are the old guano mines. You want to roll in them? No, thank you. How long do I stand in the bottom of the pit to come up with what I do, as in rope? Good question, because with rope, Anna kind of echoes my emotions. We used to be very close, you know, in the way we acted, but, you know, in the years and years and years, she's evolved one way, I've evolved another way. That's the way it happens. But emotionally, we still are very much together. And I was going through a horrible time, and I felt nailed in to a box. And so I kept thinking, I call my sister all the time, Molly, by the way, and coming up with these different ideas, and the venue in which Anna was starting kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And my sister said, why don't you just put her in a coffin? Jeez, you know. So I finally came down to the solution hole, and the only way that I could express this horrible trapped sensation that the world was that I was feeling was to strip Anna naked, bonk her on the head, and throw her in that hole. So it took 120 pages for me to work a way out of that, because it's kind of like painting yourself in the corner. Okay, you stripped her naked, you bonked her on the head, you threw her in a hole. What now? You got an alien ship going to come down and beam her up? You know, you got to get her out of here. And so I was down there for 120 pages, and about page 75 or something, I thought, I was just dying of loneliness, so I gave her the baby skunk. You know, you just got to have something to go with. And the acting thing, I think, not only does it make this stuff fun for me, I love speaking to groups. And in fact, I was at a thing a million years ago in Colorado with a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist who could write me into the ground any day of the week, but he was so terrified to speak in front of people. It's like they dragged this genius out from behind his computer. And so it holds me in good stead for this kind of thing. And I think also for dialogue. Acting is all about dialogue, and it's all about character, and it's all about eavesdropping and snooping and watching and copying and trying to make realistic. So I think that it helped a ton in that aspect. Question was, why do the murder mysteries keep getting more and more violent. Is it a reflection of the society? And this is slightly off the subject. I will come back, I promise. But I went to see Gorillas in the Mist when it came out. I was by myself. I used to go to the movies. I loved going to the movies by myself. And in front of me was a perfect, you know, mama and daddy and the one son, you know, the urban couple, and the little boy's about 6 years old, and they start Gorillas in the Mist, and there's a mist, and there's these little gorillas coming out, and there's a baby gorilla with mama gorilla, and the mother says to the son, and I'm sitting behind them, "Look, there's baby gorillas." And the little five-year-old says, "Yeah, kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them." So, but I think the reason they become more violent in series, and some of them start totally violent, so, you know, but Anna didn't start that violent, is because this is the 18th one, and, you know, or 19th or 20th, or, you know, different people, the 10th or the 11th. And you, first of all, you mine your character's neuroses and their strengths, and you go through the different situations they can be set in, and you kind of have to take it up a notch. One way or another, either you take it up a notch romantically, or you take it up a notch in what is more dangerous, or what is more frightening, or, you know, but if you don't go up a notch, you'll bore yourself to death, because you're writing this stuff, and you want to be stimulated to write it properly. So I think that a natural increase of violence is kind of an offshoot of that. And I think it's a shame. In fact, this, I usually don't have too many four-letter words in my books, because my second grade teacher, Mrs. White, who I adored, and Mr. White, two teachers, Mrs. White, first through fourth, Mr. White, fifth through eighth. This is my grammar school, 33 kids in the whole school. Three of them were dead, but they needed to register them to get the school. So I went to this tiny school, and after my third or fourth book, and Mrs. White was in, Mr. and Mrs. White were in an old folks' home, and Mrs. White, of course, had read it, and she said, "You know, Nevada, nobody's ever read a book and said, you know, there are too few obscene words in this." So, but in this last one, I mean, you know, to do a character thing, I did put in many obscene words, but it was to create a character study. But I think that is just a natural progression of books that are, because murder mysteries are based on violence, and they're based on finding things out. And I think it's why we all find a one-off very refreshing. You know, because I'm not going to get to the point I'm putting cigarettes out on nuns. You know, I have my limits. But very good question. I promise you, but okay.
Has anybody ever tried to put Anna on film?
Has anybody ever tried to put Anna on film? I have made a nice little sum of money, because many, many years, I've been writing for I don't know how long, but many years it will be optioned. And so they give me a little bit of money, which means somebody can take it to Hollywood and try to sell it. But once it is optioned, they don't want the author anywhere near it. And you know they're going to cast Pamela Anderson as Anna. You know, and there's nothing you can do about it. So it came very close a couple times, which was quite terrifying, because it was, things were so inappropriate. Well, like the Jack Reacher movie. Tom Cruise, I love Tom Cruise. He's adorable. Short, but adorable. And Jack Reacher, I mean, it's not like there's not these fabulous stories that have been written by Lee Child about Jack Reacher. They throw all that out and just do this dumb thing. So it has been optioned, and it is one of those things where, selling or not selling, you don't know what you're hoping for. So I'm glad to just take my little option money and run away. We have time for one more question, I've been promising. This is a question about winter study from a woman who loves Minnesota winters, a very strong woman. And she was wondering how much time I spent on Isle Royale. I went up there with the winter study group for 10 days. And I begged and pleaded and whined, and because they don't like people to go. The superintendent didn't want anybody to go. And finally, what's the wolf guy? Ralph Peterson. I'd met him once, you know, when I was in my 20s and he was in his 30s. And I'd been whining, and Ralph was now like about ready to retire. And he finally said to the superintendent, "Just let her come. You know, come on." So the Forest Service flew me out there on the ice, and I stayed 10 days. And it was amazing because I don't like winter. And I'd gone on my roommate Beth, who was one of these young, springy people who, you know, rescue squirrels and whatnot, these, you know, young people that save the world, and I just adored her. And so I went with a hike with her one day, but I couldn't keep up. And so the next day I thought I'd go for a hike by myself. I mean, I'd worked there. How hard could it be? And I went on this little hike, and then I could tell the sun was going down. I thought, well, no problem. I head towards where the sun's going down. I get to Wendigo, you know, you go up. And there, I forgot about the swamps with the crisscross trees, and the sun went behind the gray sky, and I got scared, and I finally got to the water, and I had cranked my ankle out, and this was, I mean, a mile and a half. I mean, it was a non-event that you could see where a person could actually suffer serious debility or die because of lack of preparation. And so what I do is what Anna's too good to do. So I did spend 10 days up there and had the experience with the heated toilet seat and all of these marvelous things. And about day 8, I'm thinking, and I begged and whined for this, why? Careful what you wish for. Okay, it is now.
Follow up to one question.
Here we go.
Oh, pick somebody who would do Anna.
Oh, do I love this. I had first picked Dana Delaney. I thought she'd be just too cool. But now Dana and I are too old. And at first I thought when I started writing books, I mean, I was an actor. I was going to write a story so I could play the lead when they made it into a movie. But now, like, I was never a good enough actor to play the lead, so I want somebody good. And I thought, Sandra Bullock would be very good. Because you want somebody who's believable. When they say, put down that raccoon, you put that raccoon down. But somebody who also isn't like Lara somebody Tomb Raider. You know, they got to be a real regular person. Like, we're staying out, and it's this Marriott, and there's a bunch of union guys out there. And they were steel workers and auto workers. And there were a few women. And you would want somebody like these women who were tough enough to raise up to be union leaders in the steel workers union, but still real people, I mean, you know, that have problems. So Sandra Bullock, and if they went with the young Anna, maybe Scarlett Johansson, just because she's very good. And, of course, Meryl Streep could do it anywhere, anytime. She could play all of the characters and the alligator, and we'd believe it. Thank you very much. Thank you.